Red Eye is a program of alternative politics and culture which broadcasts live from 9 until noon every Saturday morning on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM and around the world at cooperadio.org. Here's Lorraine Chisholm.
Samsu Mia from Ethiopia lived in a church in Ottawa for 17 months. Amir Kazmian from Iran is still living in a church here in Vancouver. He's been there since June. These are two of a handful of refugees who have received sanctuary when their applications for refugee status were turned down. According to Janet Dench of the Canadian Council of Refugees, these cases are evidence that the refugee determination system in Canada is broken and needs to be fixed. But instead, things just got a whole lot worse with the implementation of a new agreement with the U.S. The Safe Third Country Agreement came into effect on December 29th, and it will see most refugees entering Canada from the U.S. turn back at the border. Janet Dench joins me this morning from Ottawa. Good morning, Janet.
Good morning.
Thanks a lot for joining me.
My pleasure.
Let's look first of all at the situation for refugees who make it to Canada. Why do people like Samsu Mia and Azir Kazemian end up living in churches?
The refugee determination system in Canada has a very strange feature to it, which is that there is only one person that makes a decision on your case. You go before the Immigration and Refugee Board, you tell your story, you're asked questions, they look at the evidence, and this one board member that hears your case decides whether or not they think you're a refugee. And we all know that everybody makes mistakes, and particularly when you're talking about refugee determination, you're talking about situations of human rights violations in another country. Often it's difficult to get information. Often you're having to rely heavily on the person that is telling their own story, and often there's interpretation involved, cultural barriers. We also have great variety in the board members. Some of them are highly qualified, very sensitive people. Some of them, unfortunately, are not. And the result is that there's great variety in the decision-making, and there are mistakes that are made. But the system does not have an appeal to correct those mistakes. There is one in the law, and you said that the system is broken. Well, in our view, what is broken about the system is the failure of the government to implement its own law, the law that was passed by Parliament, because the law passed by Parliament in 2001 says that refugee claimants should have access to a refugee appeal division. But then in 2002, the government announced that they were going to implement the law without implementing this right to the Refugee Appeal Division.
Why does this have an effect on refugees who go into sanctuary?
So somebody who has been refused and who knows that they are at risk if they're sent back to their home country, then they're looking around for what they can do. And the system does not allow them to get that error corrected. And some of them, and it's only a very minority of the people who are wrongly rejected, but some of them come to the attention of churches, and when they explain their situation and say, can you help, the church people, who often are fairly conservative people who certainly don't rush to do anything that would be in violation of the law, but when they hear the individual situations that these claimants are facing and they realize how the Canadian system is failing them, how the government is failing them because it hasn't implemented its own laws, then some people say, well, we have to stand in and offer the protection that the government is failing to offer.
As you mentioned, there used to be two adjudicators, which seems like then you're having two people kind of looking at the situation of any refugee, and now there's only one. What kind of recourse is there? I understand that the appeal process hasn't been implemented. So what happens now if a refugee, for instance, is ordered to go back to their country? Can they appeal on any grounds?
The options you have are to try to go to the federal court for what is called a judicial review, which is very limited in nature. It's not a question of whether the decision was wrong. It's only a question of whether the board member made some mistakes, legal mistakes, in how they arrived at the decision. And you have to get leave from the federal court, and only a very small percentage of applications for judicial review are granted permission or leave by the federal court. So even people who try that, and basically you need to get a lawyer, and many people can't afford that. If you don't get anywhere on that avenue, which is the majority of places, the other recourse that people have is before they are removed, they have access to something called the pre-removal risk assessment, which is where a bureaucrat will review the claim if you submit only new evidence. So you can't say, well, the first decision was wrong. All you can produce is new evidence since the first decision was made. So if you, for example, something has happened in your home country, change of government, or something happened to some of your family members which show that you would now be at risk, you can introduce that. But it doesn't help if the problem was that the original decision was simply wrong. And you don't have new evidence. It's just that the wrong first decision needs to be corrected. So those are the two recourses that are available before you can be removed.
So it sounds to me also, what you're saying is wrong with the process itself is that you basically have one shot at it with one person, and that the standards for who that person might be vary to a great degree in terms of their experience and sensitivity to the refugee process.
That's correct. And the government, the former minister, Judy Scrow, she recognized the problem in the quality of the board members and made a reform to the appointment system so that it would be less politicized, because for a long time, who gets appointed has had more to do with who has connections with the political party in power than what competences the person has had. So there has been a reform, and that's very positive, but the problem is that people who are making decisions now, and people who have been making decisions for the last few years, they continue to be people who were appointed under the old system, and therefore there are, as I say, very vast variations in the qualifications and the competencies of the people that are making the decisions, which means that for many refugee claimants, the refugee system is a bit like a lottery. What happens depends more on which board member happens to hear your case than actually the merit of your claim.
Parliament did approve the appeal process, as you mentioned, in 2001. Why hasn't that been implemented?
This is a very good question that we never get a straight answer to. We are, and our members are, constantly asking the government and pressing them to live up to their promise. In fact, former Minister of Immigration, Denis Coderre, promised to our organization, the Canadian Council for Refugees, in 2002, that the appeal would be implemented within a year. And now it's more than 2.5 years later, and we still haven't seen that refugee appeal. At the time when they announced that they weren't going to implement the appeal, they referred to the fact of the numbers of claimants that were in the system, which to us seemed completely unacceptable and shocking, that you would say you would deny justice to people simply because there were too many people who needed justice. But even if you accept that argument, it no longer stands and hasn't for some time, because the numbers of claimants in the system have gone down dramatically, and that is partly due to the efforts of the Canadian government to make it more difficult for refugee claimants to get to Canada and to claim our protection.
Now, last summer, the then Immigration Minister, Judy Scrow, asked churches to stop providing sanctuary, calling it a back door into Canada. What's your reaction to her statement?
She is pointing the finger at the churches when the fault lies with the government. The government, we have to remember, it is the government that is has the legal obligation to protect refugees. The government of Canada has signed on to the convention relating to the status of refugees, and therefore, as a government, it has committed itself not to send someone back to persecution. What people in the churches are saying to the government by offering sanctuary is that if you fail to live up to your obligations, we will have to offer protection in your stead. The finger-pointing needs to be towards the government, who is failing to offer adequate protection to refugees. Churches are offering sanctuary publicly to give individual protection to the refugees, but also to state very publicly that the situation is intolerable and that there is a gap in the protection that Canada is offering to refugees.
Let's turn, Janet, now to look at the Safe Third Country Agreement. This was passed in 2002, but just implemented 3 weeks ago. Can you explain how it's going to work?
The principle of safe third country is that a refugee claimant has, on his or her way to Canada, has passed through a third country which supposedly is safe. And so the principle is that instead of asking for Canada's protection, the refugee claimant should ask in this other safe country. And the country we're talking about is the United States. Canada has designated the United States as safe, and it's vice versa. The U.S. has designated Canada as safe. And this means that for most refugee claimants who are coming to Canada, passing through the United States and arriving at the land border between the two countries, when they try to make their claim now, they are simply sent back to the United States on the assumption that they can make their claim in the U.S. and find safety there. We very strongly dispute that contention. We do not believe that the United States is a safe country for all refugees. Certainly, the U.S. does protect many refugees. We acknowledge that, but not for all refugees. We have a number of concerns, particularly around the use of detention. Many asylum seekers in the United States are detained in violation of international law in the U.S., often in quite atrocious conditions. There have been a lot of reports and investigations into the way immigrant detainees are held in the United States, abuses of various kinds. Plus, being in detention in the United States makes it very difficult for people to actually secure asylum, to win in the process. Some asylum seekers we know simply give up because living in detention in the United States is so unpleasant that they may decide that they will take the risk of persecution in their home country rather than endure the certainty of months, if not years, of detention in jails in the United States.
And now, is the flow of refugees that comes to Canada from the United States, is that a large percentage of the refugees that we see applying for status in Canada?
Traditionally, about a third of the claimants in Canada apply at the U.S.-Canada land border and therefore would be affected by the agreement. Now, there are some exceptions to the agreement. People, for example, who have family members, close family members in Canada, may be exempted from it. So we don't necessarily expect the numbers to drop by a third. And in fact, whether the numbers will drop significantly in the long term remains to be seen, because most people expect, and this is partly based on experience in Europe, who has also used where the same safe third mechanism has been used, most people expect that what we will see is an increase in smuggling, because people who manage to get across the border without being detected at the land border points can make their refugee claim in Canada. And therefore, one expects that smugglers will step up and offer people who are desperate for protection, who need Canada's protection, will offer this alternative route, which means that then the main beneficiaries of the agreement will in fact be smugglers.
Why do you think the Canadian government passed this legislation in 2002?
The Canadian government has been trying to secure this agreement for many years. There was an agreement similar to this in the 1990s that was being negotiated with the U.S. government, but eventually the U.S. government saw that it was not in their interests and backed away. Then, following the events of September 11, 2001, the Canadian government, who went into negotiations with the U.S. about the smart border on various issues related to security, they decided to slip in this, say, third measure, which, as I've just pointed out, because it's likely to increase smuggling at the border, is really not in any way something that could be said to improve security at the border, quite the opposite. But the Canadian government put this in, and the U.S. government accepted it to some extent, probably as a bargaining counter. But basically, the Canadian government's objective is to reduce the number of claimants in Canada. It is one element in a larger strategy which is intended to prevent people from being able to get to Canada and to claim our protection, which is a pretty pitiful objective to have, given, apart from everything else, that Canada, one of the richest countries in the world, we're also geographically placed. That means that very few of the world's refugees ever get to Canada. Most of the refugees are in the poor countries of the world. A tiny number get to us, but even that tiny number that get to Canada, the government is trying to reduce still further by putting up barriers of various kinds towards refugee claimants trying to get here.
Well, Janet, thank you very much for joining us today. That really kind of clarifies, I think, some very important issues and should really raise our attention to this issue of barriers to refugees coming to Canada.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Janet Dench. Janet is the Executive Director of the Canadian Council of Refugees. And now I'm joined in the studio by Harjep Graywal. Harjep is an organizer with the group No One is Illegal, which is organizing an upcoming event titled Canadian Refugee Camp, The Resistance Within Fortress North America. Good morning, Harjep. Thanks for joining me in the studio.
Thank you for having me.
What will people encounter as they walk by the Vancouver Art Gallery on February 5th?
Well, the idea of the camp is that it's not actually going to be a refugee camp in terms of representing a refugee camp in the third world. The idea is to sort of represent how Canada itself is, in a way, a refugee camp. So there will be largely a lot of information displays. There will be some music. You know, people from different communities that have been affected by immigration policy in Canada, past and present, there. And sort of the idea of it is to, for the general public, but for also the communities that will be present there, to sort of get an idea of what these policies have been, how they're affecting communities here, and sort of, you know, what Canada's overall interest is in their immigration policies and how it relates to some of their foreign policy as well.
Now, I understand that you're going to be having a timeline of events in that relate to Canadian immigration history. What are some of the key moments that you're going to be highlighting and bringing to people's attention?
Well, there's several key moments, and the idea is also to bring some of those you know, some of these key moments in Canadian immigration history and relate them to what's happening today. And for example, one of the examples is the Kamagata Maru. It was a boat of Punjabi refugees that had come here and was not allowed to land on the shores of Canada. But the interesting thing at that time is that, you know, we've just been talking about the Safe Third Country Agreement, and that the boat coming all the way from India, the whole idea of them coming through a direct passage is that there was this idea that you had to have a continuous journey in order to land in Canada. Now, this Safe Third Country Agreement is essentially the same thing. Canada's had a history of trying to create barriers for people coming here. Another good example is the Chinese head tax. I mean, it's just making it more and more difficult for people to even reunite with their families, immigrate to Canada, seek refugee status in Canada, and you know, that's a good example of it. The Japanese internment is another sort of a good example of what sort of immigration or racial policy in Canada was, and there's a good example of that now as well. I mean, you know, the Japanese internment is not that much different than some of the security certificates and some of the legislation that's been passed for the government and CSIS and other organizations in Canada to allow them to detain essentially refugees or non-status people without giving them any sort of idea what the allegations are against them, and basically allowing them to detain them for an infinite amount of time.
Well, there's certainly, we're always fond in Canada of kind of talking about, you know, our kind of cultural mosaic and tapestry, but it seems like there's quite a mosaic and quite a history of real kind of lack of sensitivity and compassion to people coming to Canada who are often in very, very terrible situations.
Well, and that's the key. Like, I think it's some of the titles and some of the slogans that we're getting ready for this camp and some of our literature has is that it's breaking the myths of sort of humanitarianism and compassion in Canadian immigration policy. And the funny thing is that when you travel around the world, a lot of people still assume that Canadian immigration policy is still quite good. It's very comparable to some of the best policies around the world. But, you know, we've had some refugees that we're working with the Refugee Committee here in Vancouver that have, you know, been through the American process and also been through the Canadian process. And some of them even say that the Canadian process is actually much worse.
What are some of the differences that you see now? So you start to draw some similarities there between events of the past and events currently taking place. But what are some of the differences that you start to see coming in with recent kind of changes to immigration policy?
Well, it's interesting. Sort of the work we've been doing is actually looking at some of the similarities. But I think there are some small differences, but it also sometimes just is a matter of language. One interesting thing that we're looking at, for example, is that in the early 1900s, there was a Department of Immigration and Colonization, which was sort of, you know, the people that were determining who can come into the country and who cannot. And that sort of identifies a direct link to Canadian foreign policy and the idea of controlling resources while also controlling the labor force and people's movement, sort of why colonial borders are created in the first place. And so it's interesting that we're looking at now, for example, some of the policies that Canada has with other foreign countries, such as Paul Martin's recent trip to Libya. He visits Libya, a regime that's been known for, you know, ages. You know, most of Hollywood and Canadian television has constantly told people that, you know, it's a horrible regime, much like Saddam Hussein. Gaddafi is not that much different. But now Paul Martin goes there and he has trade talks, and I think SNC-Lavalin gets a new contract. SNC-Lavalin, sorry, is that company that's, providing bullets for the war in Iraq and also part of the RAF project here. So he goes there and they get the contracts there. And what's happening now is a lot of refugees from Libya that have normally very easily gotten asylum here in Canada are, you know, some of them have deportation orders. And so it's interesting to look at that. The similar situation happened with Algeria. Algeria, there were 500 people being deported from in Montreal to Algeria. At the same time, Canada was negotiating trade talks with Algeria, but there was also a travel advisory to Algeria, and Algeria was going through a war that had killed about 100,000 people in the last 10 years.
These are very interesting connections you're making, because what we're seeing here is the relatively how we see other countries based on what our business relationships are with them, and somehow the human rights record or the danger to people who are outside the system or not in the good graces of the government there changes depending on what our business relationships are.
Well, that's exactly it, and part of the reason is that we're trying to put forward some of this analysis to, you know, the larger population. But I also think it's important to sort of, for a lot of the community that's been involved in, say, the anti-globalization movement and some of the movements against, you know, imperialism, colonialism, it's important to draw this link, the fact that, you know, looking at Canadian policy, of course, Canada, the U.S. are pushing open borders for trade, for money, for goods, but there aren't open borders for people. And it's a very, very important distinction, because I think that's a very much a part of the colonial imperial project, that you want to be able to control the labor that comes here. And in addition to that, I mean, one of the things that we're going to be highlighting in the camp is some of these immigration policies. For example, the live-in caregiver program, which much of the Filipino community here has been affected by, and some of the South Asian community as well. And what that is that, you know, you want to be able to direct your labor. I mean, the farm workers that came here in the sort of mid-1900s that were working on the farms, again, were directed labor. Chinese community that came here working on the railroad, directed labor. As soon as the railroad is finished, you have a head tax on Chinese coming here. I mean, it's essentially like controlling the labor, using what you need to do for business purposes here, and also keeping borders closed so that you can control that, but at the same time opening the borders for resources and everything else that you need to get for your business interests.
I think this is very compelling analysis, and I'm wondering how, as an organizer with this camp, which is the idea of the symbolic camp is to create a connect between what the reality is for refugees, yet at the same time there's a big disconnect in the Canadian psyche about, like, you know, how generous and welcoming we are to refugees. So I'm wondering what you see the challenges are to kind of break through that disconnect, and also at the same time to speak to people in a language that they understand. Because when I hear the imperial colonialist project, it's like that's kind of a turnoff for people, right? So how do you make the connections with ordinary Canadians who've kind of who've bought these myths because that's what the PR is? So what are the challenges?
Well, I think some of the challenges are actually presenting just some of the basic information to begin with. I mean, we don't need to sit, you know, at this point. I mean, some of the people that we can hopefully talk about these imperial projects, but I think it's important also just to present some information. For example, some of the myths, you know, a lot of people assume that Canada takes in a lot of refugees. If you look at the amount of refugees that are displaced around the world, we take a very, very minute percentage of the refugees that are around the world. I mean, countries like Pakistan have taken so many, I think close to millions of refugees from the since the Afghan war, but we don't really consider that, we don't really see that as, that as accepting refugees. We think that our system is really accepting them. And, you know, looking at the Safe Third Country, they're still trying to decrease that number. But also it's looking at breaking some of these myths and ideas of, you know, like just what is displacement in the third world. I mean, we don't have to talk about imperial projects very directly that way, but we can talk about the fact that, you know, companies like Alcan are in various countries in the world taking, you know, indigenous land and displacing people off their land. These people then are, you know, displaced populations, and we see that here even in Canada. I mean, you know, one of the parallels that we draw is obviously with the indigenous communities here that are constantly displaced off their land. We were part of the Sun Peaks organizing that happened in August, and that is a displacement off of their land as well, and that happens in the third world, and these people end up either going to the cities looking for work, which are horrible conditions for people to go in the third world, and then obviously with not that much work available, many people look for better, you know, better circumstances anywhere in the world. And that displacement, I think people have to recognize that somehow there is a connect between that displacement and corporate policies, maybe, you know, or, you know, business interests in these countries from the West.
Why do you think this is important for people to kind of shift their understanding and start to kind of get that Canada really needs to change its attitude and policies towards refugees?
Well, I think one of the key things is that there's several reasons. One of the key reasons is that we have to also recognize that, you know, we're looking at a situation where a lot of people are talking about around the world right now, the war in Iraq, foreign policies, some of the regimes that are around the world. Refugees are often the human face of all of these devastations. You know, they're the people that are fleeing persecution from, you know, dictatorships. They're the people that are fleeing a war or a war-torn country. And Canada's obligations, you know, they've made obligations to the UN internationally to help these people. Now, I think it's important to also look at what these people face when they come here. Refugees, the process they go through, sort of like, you know, them not being able to work, some of them working for $4 an hour when they come here because they don't have status, detentions that happen. I mean, a lot of the media, when they came to some of these events that happened or deportations that were happening in the Iranian community, they saw these deportations happening at the immigration center and they were shocked. And I think what happens to happen is that for people to recognize this, because if people recognize this, people need to support the refugees, because the refugees in this country are scared. They will not, it's hard for them to fight for their rights without status. You can be deported and detained anytime. But for them to come out and see that people understand their issues and there's people on the streets actually supporting them, I think is one of the biggest, you know, most helpful things that can happen, not only for them to be able to fight for their rights, but also for, you know, people to understand that, you know, some of Canada's refugee policy, as Jenna was talking about earlier, is not what it is sort of, you know, portrayed as by the government.
And I think, you know, a result of this kind of some of the activism that we've seen around this is that we've actually seen some successful cases of people being released.
And that's exactly it. I mean, you know, Hale Sabah, who is a women's rights activist that got deported to Iran, we had 2 days to organize for that. There was a lot of support that was built, but, you know, in 2 days, it's very difficult for people to come out and to give that sort of support. With Ali's case, Ali Reza, who's just won his stay order, there was a tremendous amount of support. I mean, you know, 30 to 40 people were up in his court hearing, and about 50 to 60 people were downstairs demonstrating at the same time against his deportation. And what that's allowed people to do is that through Hale's case, people have sort of become aware on sort of a, you know, on a sort of semi-conscious level that there are some problems with the refugee process here, but this is an opportunity for people to really see what the problems are, fight against some of these problems, such as the appeals division, such as having a one-person panel to determine whether you're a refugee, such as some of these, you know, sort of appeals that they have, but they only, you know, like the humanitarian and compassionate grounds and the pre-removal risk assessment, but they only have about a 3%, you know, success rate, which, you know, people have to recognize these problems, support the refugees, and then, you know, being more aware of this, I think it'll be easier for people to do that as well.
Well, I really appreciate your coming down and talking with us, telling us about the Canadian refugee camp that's going to be happening next month, and we'll point people there.
Yeah.
Go on down, find out more about these issues, and get involved.
February 5th, there's that, and also if people want to find a little bit more about this, there's also Naomi Klein, along with two other speakers from the Longshore and No One Is Illegal, will be speaking on a panel on February 2nd as well. So there'll be more information there.
Awesome. Thanks for joining me.
No problem.
I've been speaking with Harjap Graywal. He's an organizer with No One Is Illegal here in Vancouver. The Canadian refugee camp is being held, as we've mentioned, on Saturday, February 5th from noon until 5 p.m. in front of the Vancouver Art Gallery, and there will be a rally and march starting at 1 p.m. And you can find a little bit more on their website. No One Illegal's website is at noii.resist.ca.
You've been listening to Red Eye, a program produced by an alternative media collective in Vancouver, Canada. Red Eye broadcasts live every Saturday morning from 9 until noon and can be heard around the world at cooperadio.org.